The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Right-wing media, the global warming deniers and doubters and disinformers are alive and well. I'm happy to tell you that, or actually not so happy to tell you that, but I can tell you that with some authenticity because I was brave or crazy enough to go into the lion's den, into the jaws of the lion this week on Monday night. I ventured forth into enemy territory. Unfortunately, it still is definitely that. Makes no sense, I know, but made no dollars for me, just wanted to go in and see if I could just instill a little bit of truth and reality check to these guys who were still saying the same old garbage 2 years after I was last on the Hannity show, went on Monday night, and Hannity's replacement, Tucker Carlson, was no wiser, no more intelligent, no more sane than his usual guy, Sean Hannity and friends. I was on with Chris Horner. He is the guy who I debated 3 times prior, and he is still spewing the same garbage, I'm sorry to say. To talk about that and some other more positive developments, I'm going to be introducing my good friend, Gail Friend, in just a moment. Gail Friend is the founder of and president of a company called Natural Logic that's been out there as long as I have, even longer. Going to find out a little bit more about what they do and about extended producer responsibility, one of their primary focuses. Gail is also an author, a speaker, and happened to catch my appearance and had some, well, I thought quite apropos comments. So we're going to start with that. Gail, are you with us on the Green Front?
I am, Betsy. Good morning.
Good morning, and thanks for being with us on short notice. I know you're on your way to the dentist's office, so I appreciate your taking a few minutes to let's just first get the bad stuff out of the way. You saw this fourth encounter of mine with these folks
man,
at Fox.
I sure did.
Faux news, let's call them, and there's nothing newsy about it. It's a deliberate attempt to obfuscate, to disinform, to really hold back progress and even reverse it on the Green Front, especially when it comes to climate change. Pretty outrageous, isn't it, that there's still saying these things that are completely untrue, outrageous, totally incendiary, you know, shedding all heat, no light. And my Green friends have asked, well, why go on there? And I'll get to that in a moment. But first, wanted to get your overall impression.
Well, overall impression is very consistent with yours. Your co-guest, I don't think they introduced him as such, but he works for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, whose job it is to push oil industry propaganda. Tucker Carlson, who used to be a fairly intelligent moderator in his former life, obviously got the memo from the brass at Fox News that said, anytime you mention a climate change story, be sure to say these things, and he sure said them.
He did. He must have got a real big paycheck.
I think he gets a real big paycheck, and he's probably paid by the word because he kept talking over you, and you did a really good job of holding clear and clean to the story.
And it's not easy because they do invite guests on to tear them down. And so if one wonders, well, why go on there? You know, they're smarmy and why even legitimize their existence? I just keep, you know, call me foolish, call me an optimist. I just keep believing that with the facts on our side, with the truth on our side, we will prevail eventually. And I guess I just think with millions of viewers, which they have, and they're laughing all the way to the bank, these guys get, you know, paid very well to disseminate these lies and perpetuate them, that maybe we'll get to a few people. But even beyond any, you know, hope of trying to convert the religious on their side, it's really just a chance to try to, you know, maybe just pick away. You can't knock these guys down, but just try to, you know, invoke a little bit of doubt and encourage a little bit of questioning. And when it's so obvious.
And some people will respond. if you get through to a few, you've done your work.
And really, they got me again, because sometimes I think I'm not going to, if they do call again, go on. But this is one of my favorite, biggest pet peeves, as I'm sure it's yours too. As the snow is coming down, as the blizzard is pummeling the East Coast, which, by the way, was scrolling across during our segment,
sure.
You know, airport shut down, East Coast digging out of record storm. They're saying, you know, not only is this a proof that there's not global warming, but, you know, won't even entertain the possibility that, you know, even though this is exactly what climate scientists have been predicting with this wet weather, you know, chaos and extremes and more intense, you know, bizarre, freaky storms across the globe. I mean, they scoff at that. They don't want to hear the answer.
Well, look, some climate skeptics have legitimate scientific concerns, which is the nature of the scientific process. You want questioning, you want skepticism, you want pushing back on the facts. Unfortunately, a lot of climate deniers, and I think the folks you're on the air with, don't have a lot of interest in facts and don't have a lot of interest in science. And it's very easy for them to confuse people about the difference between weather and climate. You know, weather is short-term variation. Climate is long-term trends. Within long-term trends, you have a lot of short-term variation, and any of your listeners just have to look at your own lives. And you know that summers are hot and cold, and days are warm and cold, and it rains or it doesn't. What's important is the long-term trends. The long-term trends are clear, and even more fundamentally, the physics is absolutely inarguable. If you put more energy into a climatic system, which we do, by using more fossil fuels and, you know, energy growth around the world, and if you change the ability of that climatic system to radiate heat, which we do, by putting more greenhouse gases into the system, the physics are very simple. The climate can't not change. Like if you put a tea kettle on the stove and turned up the heat, it's going to get hotter. You put a tea cozy on top of it, it's going to get hotter faster. And you can argue all you want about the speed of the change and about the pattern of the change and about how the complex systems of climate play out in ways that seem to be chaotic sometimes, but the direction is absolutely as unmistakable as if you drop an apple, it will fall to the floor.
And it's simple. Gravity
is the law, and thermodynamics is the law, and there's no political perspective that trumps that.
And why do they think that burning some 80 million barrels of oil a day, as we have been for several decades here on Earth, would have no impact? I mean, it's almost like they're just defying science and arrogantly.
I think they don't want to be confused by the fact. But what's a lot more interesting to me, Betsy, is the response of the business community to this. Because there you have people who have their butts on the line, who have consequences to their actions, and who understand that that it makes no money, it makes no sense to throw good money after bad. It makes no sense to be dependent on fossil fuels whose price is only going to rise, whose supply is unreliable, the payment for which exports money out of the United States and doesn't support the U.S. economy. So we're seeing more and more businesses saying thank you very much to Fox and thank you very much to Congress, but moving forthrightly to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and do it profitably.
And I think it's good business as well as
good environmental responsibility.
And was there the beginning, the flickering, a glimmering of agreement perhaps on Tucker Carlson's part when I did try to shift gears when they were talking about Martians and spacecraft landing and other forms of alien life to the practicalities of, okay, even if you don't believe science, how about if we just start taking, you know, measures and implementing policies that will at least get America, you know, on the front track to get, you know, clean tech, you know, advancement ahead of the countries that are already starting, which has, you know, been China most notably and India and many European nations right behind them. While we're twiddling, home is burning. So let's just get to the practicalities if you don't want to debate the science all, you know, for eternity. And I think he started to agree with that point.
I couldn't tell what he was agreeing with because he was talking so much about spaceships. but what you said is exactly the point. You know, from the perspective of the companies that we work with, this is a no-regret strategy. If you can do things today that will be profitable for your company and improve your product and improve your customer relationships and build your brand, and, by the way, also reduce your greenhouse gas emissions, you'd be a fool not to do that, and more companies understand that. The Defense Department understands that. The Defense Department is now leading the United States on climate prevention. For them, it's $400 a gallon to get diesel fuel to the front lines in Afghanistan. They don't want to do that anymore.
And these are people who are, you know, hawkish not on the climate. They're soft on climate, but they are, you know, hawkish on military, you know, boosting and, you know, fortifying our troops.
doesn't matter.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't matter. People have different political perspectives. James Woolsey, former head of the CIA, has been one of the leading advocates for the transition to renewables in the United States. The U.S. Navy now has the highest renewable portfolio standard in the country. And, you know, what we're seeing in our work, we work primarily with large corporations. We help them design, implement, and measure profitable sustainability strategies. And what we're seeing there is that companies are increasingly stepping up to the plate, not looking at superficial green improvements, but really asking some deep strategic questions, hard questions, challenging ones, making us work to earn our pay, but looking deeply at how does this transition affect business strategy and the business landscape in the future. And they're putting their money on the perspective that says we need to reinvent this economy, take it out of 19th century technologies and fuels and energy sources into 21st century sources, build American energy independence, improve the efficiency and productivity of the economy, and improve quality of life along the way. It's a very heartening change, and frankly, it's dramatically different than where these companies were 5 years ago.
If you're just joining us on the Green Front, I am speaking to my good friend, Gil Friend. He is the author and much sought-after speaker. His latest book, The Truth About Green Business, it's about to go into its second printing, or maybe it just has. So he knows of which he speaks, and he's been working closely with corporations who want to move to a more sustainable track and believe that is the future, regardless of what is or is not happening at the national and international level to legislate this. The name of his company is Natural Logic. Gil, tell us a little bit more about how your book was received, The Truth About American Green Business, and that is a provocative title. It sounds as if you're going to give us some inside scoop, if that's the case. And I've had it on my nightstand. I haven't read it yet, but I have heard you speak so many times. I know you're, you know, a great expert and have a lot of insight, you know, because you've been working deeply with these companies and so many of them for more than a decade. How long have you been at this, by the way?
About 38 years, but who's counting?
Oh, my. And you don't look a day over 38, so you're doing the right thing. Green agrees with
you. Yep. Well, the book is The Truth About Green Business. It's published by Financial Times Press. We're actually already in our second printing, heading for the third, and also coming out early next year with an e-learning version of the book that will be available for companies to have on their desk of employee training for their entire workforce. The headline of the book, or the subtitle of the book, is you don't have to choose between making money and making sense. And that's really the core message, because so many people assume that you have to choose one or the other, either make money or be responsible, either make money or be environmentally sensible. And the message we say is, no, you don't have to make that choice. You get both of them. If you run smart, you get to have both of them. And the book is published by Financial Times Press in a very fast-paced, accessible format for busy executives and busy people in companies, very practical. I'm glad to say that Alex Stephan at World Changing and John Elkington at Sustainability Limited have called it the best green business book around, so we're pleased with that. And more to the point, the executives who are reading it are telling us this is really practical. We can really put this to work, and that's what we try to accomplish with that.
And another accolade for you, the finance firm Rose Ryan has named you, Gil Friend, one of the top 25 movers and shakers in the Bay Area. And that's saying a lot, because we have a lot of movers and shakers and muckers, especially the green variety in Northern California. So good for you. And I understand you have just released a white paper on EPR. For those who don't know, that stands for Extended Producer Responsibility, or Producer Responsibility, something that's been near and dear to my heart since I first met up with Bill Sheehan with the Zero Waste Project back then, back at one of the national recycling conferences I went to. And I remember standing outside at 2 a.m. in some city somewhere at the curb interviewing him and being fascinated. Shows you how trashy I am. Strange I am, but I always found this, you know, concept so logical and so needed. And how far have we come in the last decade as far as companies taking responsibility for the entire life cycle of their products, like a computer, for instance?
We've made progress. There's been a lot of regulatory progress in Europe, but more interesting to me is that a number of companies have stepped forward and said this is something we need to do. Hewlett-Packard, for example, a very notable one, was a leader. Actually, you know, Dell and HP argue over who was first on this, which I think is a lovely argument.
Perfect.
To take back computers at the end of life and properly remanufacture or refurbish or recycle them, rather than letting it be the problem of the buyer. And the basic concept of extended producer responsibility is that the organization that produces what will eventually become waste should be responsible for that waste that it's at the end of life. The white paper lays out a strategy and a policy approach to wire together the financial incentives up and down the supply chain so that organizations from producers of packaging to producers of computer products to producers of beverages are incentivized financially to be responsible for that waste. And what that incentive does is it encourages them to design better products, to lightweight the materials, to make things out of more recyclable materials, and to invest in the systems that will ensure high rates of recovery of that stuff. And I'm about to go into a stairwell, so I might get a little boomy on you here.
Gil is on his way to get a root canal and was kind enough to join us en route. That's because, first of all, when he communicated with me on Facebook that he had seen this boxing match that I was part of Monday night, I got excited about reconnecting with my good friend, and also because it is the week between Christmas and New Year's, it's a little difficult, a little more challenging than usual to line up interviews. Most people are out of town, out of their office, so bear with us as we join Gil as he makes his way to his dentist's office. But even though he apologized and said he wouldn't be, you know, at full steam, you can tell he's full of interesting comments and observations, even some facts and figures. So, Gil, do we have you? Have you ascended the steps successfully?
We're good.
Okay, so it's the end of the year. It's the end of the first decade of the century. Looking back at what's been accomplished and what has not, one of the things that stands out for me and what didn't happen, and, you know, it's a travesty, a tragedy, really, that the Senate dropped the ball on climate change legislation that the House, you know, so, you know, courageously passed, what was it, June of 2009. Never did we believe that nothing would happen, especially under, you know, our President Obama, who was not only the first black president, but we thought the great green hope in the White House. How disturbing was that to you, and what do you think the prospects are, even if cap and trade is dead, for reviving some kind of significant legislation that, as someone said, the planet will notice?
Well, cap and trade is not dead in California, Betsy.
It's not.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I'm surprised to hear you say that.
Cap and trade is not dead in California. It's dead at the federal level for now, but it's not dead in California. California fought back an oil industry-funded challenge to its world-leading climate policies, a stunningly lopsided victory. What was it, 60-30 or something like that, 65-35?
Right.
And real notably, you know, where these arguments used to be environmentalists versus business in all of our coming up years, in this case, it was environmentalists and more than 500 California companies against two out-of-state oil companies. California business understands where its self-interest is. The California public understands that. And California is going to move ahead in what, the fifth or eighth largest economy in the world, with a very progressive and creative climate strategy. Congress, I think, is going to be dead in the water for a while, and so the action is going to shift. It's going to shift from the Capitol in Washington to the state capitals, to local government, to businesses, and to individuals. And it's not how I would prefer to have it, but that's the hand we're dealt right now, and that's the one we're going to have to play.
And you mentioned Prop 23, certainly the defeat of that is a huge victory, and it had to go down. I mean, if that had been passed, and our, you know, groundbreaking legislation had by Fran Pavley, had AB 32, had been reversed, what kind of message would that have sent to the rest of the country if California could not enact its own, you know, really landmark legislation that was hopefully going to really put us on the map and the rest of the country in the light of the world in terms of tackling climate change in a real way?
Yeah, well, it would have been a disastrous message. Unfortunately, it was beaten.
Yeah.
You know, California's been such a leader on this that Governor Schwarzenegger for the past 3 years has held a global governor's summit on climate change, meeting with state-level leaders from Brazil and India and Indonesia and China and Mexico, all of whom are doing phenomenal innovation at the levels of states or provinces, regardless of where their national governments are going. China turns out to be a big surprise in this because, you know, we've had a lot of concerns about China and China, you know, massive coal burning and continued development of coal-fired power plants. China has become a renewable energy powerhouse in the world. China not only has automobile efficiency standards higher than the United States, not only has a cyclical economy policy at the national level, talking about closed loop as an industrial strategy at the national level, but they're currently outspending us on renewables by about 12 to 1.
And how go ahead.
And let me just add one stat,
yeah,
because it's really a staggering number. 12 times as much in absolute money as we are investing in renewables. And the Chinese economy is about a quarter the size of ours. So that means on a per GDP basis, China's spending 45 to 50 times as much as the United States on renewable energy. Which economy do you think is going to benefit and be the leader in the 21st century if those trends continue?
And because those who would not want us to do much on climate change and other environmental challenges tend to be pro-business, you know, pro-patriotism for America, you know who I'm talking about. It seems like this might be the one argument, you know, losing our competitive edge against, you know, a country that is already, you know, digging us deeper into debt, not their fault as much as ours.
It's something I'd love to talk to Tucker Carlson about.
Yeah, exactly, and I think he actually, you know, wanted to go that direction, but Chris Horner, you know, jumped in about spaceships and aliens, and what I should have said at that point was, well, when they land, they'll be, if they're looking for signs of intelligent life, they're not going to find it on Planet Fox, because, I mean, to quote a friend of mine, you know, these doofuses just keep on spewing the company line, and, you know,
well,
I wonder
where they're going to find intelligent life is Planet, you know, Planet DuPont and Planet Interface and Planet Walmart and Planet Coca-Cola and Planet Hewlett-Packard. And Planet, you know, Equal Exchange, and, you know, companies large and small who are saying, yeah, this is a business. It's no longer business versus environment. It's now becoming business and environment versus a dying fossil fuel industry.
And why do they cling to that, do you think? That old model?
They got a lot of money there.
So the
They got a lot of money of their own, they got a lot of assets in the ground, and they got massive subsidies from us. The global subsidies to the coal industry exceed the market capitalization of the industry. Let me say that again. The global subsidies to the coal industry are more per year than the actual market value of the industry. If you were running a business and you had a division that was performing that way, you don't have to be, you know, a Harvard MBA to figure out that you would shut that division. You would take the loss. You would pay off your severance pay. You would shutter your factories. You'd lose less money by not being in business than by being in business. And yet we, the taxpayers, subsidize these industries. So this is a place where I think there's a common agenda between the right and the left. The right wants smaller government and wants more free markets. The left wants better social justice and less pollution. Let's take out the coal industry. Let's take all that subsidy money, remediate the mines, rehabilitate the communities, train the workers, invest in renewables, and still have change left on our dollar.
And they talk about, you know, let the free marketplace take care of this, but they don't mention the fact that there is, continues to be huge subsidies for the fossil fuel industry, and there is, you know, just a beginning, you know, sort of baby steps towards trying to level the playing field to support, you know, the new green renewable technologies like solar, wind, and geothermal. President Obama's starting to do that. How confident are you that in the next 2 years of his administration we will see more proactive leadership on the green front?
We're going to see it only if his constituency pushes him for it. Only if, you know, those of us who voted for him, worked for him, or didn't, but who care about these issues, push him and push our senators and push our representatives. Because government, you know, government doesn't lead. Government responds. And it's going to be to us to make that happen. You know, there's that apocryphal story back in the Great Depression of the 1930s where President Franklin Roosevelt was meeting with labor leaders. He said, Mr. President, we need you to do this around Social Security. We need you to do this around unemployment and so forth. He said to them, I hear you. I need you to go out in the streets and make me do that. I think it's a lesson that President Obama would do well to learn.
I think that's so critical. And how do we show – I mean, some of the surveys I've read, seen a lot of research lately on, you know, Americans' views on climate change because opinions seem to be dropping in terms of the urgency. And yet, you know, a lot more Americans are concerned about this than, you know, the vocal minority right-wing media would have us believe. It seems that, you know, more people are concerned about this, but they're not letting their leaders know about it, their legislators, their representatives. And therefore, the representatives become a little, you know, too cowardly. They're afraid if they go out on a green limb, they're going to get some, you know, negative feedback on that. And that's part of the problem, isn't it, that there wasn't enough, has not been enough muscle behind this movement that reaches all the way to Washington, D.C. How can people let, you know, D.C. know that this is something that absolutely can no longer, you know, be ignored, especially with so many of these new Republicans in the Senate and Tea Partiers, you know, being climate change disinformers?
This is not rocket science. You know, you write to your legislators, you call them up on the phone, you write op-eds, you do blog posts, you talk to your neighbors, you talk to your coworkers. You talk not only to people who agree with you, you talk to people who don't agree with you. And actually, let me rephrase that. You listen to people who don't agree with you and understand where they're coming from. Because a lot of folks who seem to be on another side are misinformed or have partial information or have real concerns that aren't being addressed. So we have what you're supposed to do in a democracy is people talk to each other and figure things out together and communicate as broadly and widely as you can. That's number one. Number two, you vote. And I don't mean just voting every 2 years in elections, but all of us vote every day with our dollars. Every time we slap a dollar on the counter, we're voting. We're voting for a future. We're voting for a world. We're voting for what will happen in our country. So exercise those votes wisely. Send signals through the marketplace to companies in terms of what you buy and what you don't buy, what you ask for from the store. A friend of mine has a habit of whenever he sits down in a restaurant and the waiter brings him the menu, he looks at it and he says he's going to have this hamburger. He says, you know, can you tell me where the beef is from? And the waiter usually looks at him kind of blank-eyed.
I know that look.
Chandon says, well, could you ask the chef? Waiter goes back to the chef. Chef comes out with the waiter. They have a discussion about where the beef comes from, how it was raised, if they know. Diners sitting around them in the restaurant hear the conversation. You know, if the chef doesn't have an answer, next time he buys his beef, he might actually ask his buyer where it came from. And so there's a ripple effect of awareness and conversation. Doesn't cost you anything to do that, doesn't take any time, doesn't take you out of your way. So voting with conversation, voting with dollars, sharing awareness, that's one of the things we can do, even when the political landscape in D.C. seems to not be most cooperative.
Gil, thanks for letting us take you a little bit out of your way on your way to the dentist for a root canal procedure. I hope your close encounter with your dentist is a little less painful than my close encounter was with Tucker Carlson and Chris Horner.
It's going to be fine. My wife's a path, and so I'm well-equipped.
Thanks for joining us, Gil, and let's hope for a great year for the Greens and all folks concerned about life on this planet. Happy Greens 2011.
Happy New Year. Thanks for what you're doing. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And when we come back, we'll be talking about what more of what I'm doing, we're doing, those who would want to protect life as we know it, and that is our natural resources, nature, this one planet we call home. It's Earth, and it's the only one we've got last time I checked. So this is a good half hour because I think I'll be the guest this next half hour, talking and interviewing myself about the Green Tea Party idea we have, a little bit more inside scoop on what it was like going into the belly of the beast on Fox Network, Hannity show Monday night this week. A lot more than I've put on my Facebook page about what happened. I'll tell you the secrets. If you'd like to call and join in the conversation, this will be a great time to do it because I don't have any guests for the rest of the hour. The number to call the Progressive Radio Network studio is 888-874-4888. Would love to hear from you. Would also love to hear from you via email. Betsy@thegreenfront.com is the way to reach me directly. I also have a website that is separate from the Progressive Radio Network where you can hear the show live. All the Greenfront programs are archived at thegreenfront.com. So please go there for not only past shows on the Greenfront on Progressive Radio Network for the last 6 months or so, but also my work prior on the Air America Network. Did a show for several years, 3 years actually, called Eco Talk, and there are literally hundreds of shows archived at ecotalk.net. I'm going to stop talking for a moment. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking about things that I think are near and dear to your heart. Would love you to join the conversation. You're listening to